Good evening. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. I know it's been a long day and a long week. My name is Christina Hureyes, and I'm a partner and the chair of the United Nations Practice Group at the law firm Foley Hoag, based in New York. We represent states in international disputes before international fora, ICJ, ICC, advisory work, and ad hoc arbitrations in public and private international law. And we also work on victims' rights issues. It's really a pleasure to be here today. I have some introductory remarks, but before I dive into the specific topic, I'd like to first pass the mic to Ambassador Jorge Caraval, the ambassador of Chile to the Netherlands, for his introductory remarks. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Christina. Well, it was a pleasure to meet you here. good afternoon, distinguished panelists, esteemed guests and colleagues. It is an honor to welcome you to this event so we can engage in a vital discussion on avenues for ensuring accountability for gender-based crimes in Afghanistan. Sadly, we convene at a time of an unprecedented and systematic gender-based operation in that country. 3 years after the Taliban regained control, Afghanistan continues to face worsening human rights conditions and a humanitarian and a political crisis. The de facto authorities have deepened their institutionalized gender-based oppression, excluding women and girls from the community, while suppressing civil society, silencing the media, and disregarding fundamental principles of justice, equality, non-discrimination, and the rule of law. The legal, social, and political framework they have implemented is one that not only excludes women, but seeks to erase their voices, agency, and existence from public life altogether. The Taliban policies, including the newly enacted law on the promotion of virtue and prevention of vice, severely restrict women's and girls' fundamental freedoms, such as movement, education, work, healthcare, expression, and access to justice, while institutionalizing practices like mandatory mahram requirements, strict dress codes, and public segregation. These measures not only target women and girls, but also impact Afghans of all genders, using surveillance, violence, and coercion. The Taliban policies are causing profound physical and mental harm, including stress, isolation, depression, and rising reports of suicide among Afghan women and girls. The broader societal impact risks normalizing the subjugation of women and fostering dangerous ideologies among future generations. The Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Afghanistan warns in his most recent report that the Taliban system of oppression, marked by dehumanization and pervasive control, could constitute crimes against humanity. Then urgent action is required to prevent the normalization of this ideology and its long-term risk, security risk, from within Afghanistan and beyond. The Taliban actions are a flagrant breach of Afghanistan's international obligations. Under treaties such as the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women and customary international law. The purpose of this panel is to examine these violations in their starkest form and to consider the broader implications of defining the Taliban system as one of gender apartheid. Today's discussion will explore some critical questions. One, what are the legal obligations of Afghanistan under international law, and how do they bind the de facto Taliban authorities? Second, how does the framework of gender apartheid add to our understanding of the violation occurring in Afghanistan, and what legal or moral weight does this carry? What role can and should institutions like the International Criminal Court and the United Nations play in investigating and prosecuting these crimes? And finally, how can we, as an international community, make sure that Afghan women and girls remain at the center of every policy, every initiative, and every measure aimed at addressing this crisis? The women and girls of Afghanistan, alongside other marginalized communities, are enduring unimaginable hardships. Their courage, resilience, and hope are a powerful reminder that they must not be seen as victims alone, but as critical stakeholders in shaping Afghanistan's future. Our responsibility is clear: to amplify their voices, hold perpetrators accountable, and ensure that gender justice is not just a distant aspiration, but a reality. Thank you for being here today and for your commitment to this cause. I look forward to the insight of our panelists as we delve into this urgent issue. Together, may we work towards a future where justice prevails and human rights are upheld for all. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ambassador. Well, continuing on with my introductory remarks, for a couple years now, I've had the honor of working with Atlantic Council Civic Engagement Project and a coalition of NGOs on the End Gender Apartheid campaign, among other efforts to seek accountability with respect to the conduct of the de facto regime. And as we gather here this evening on the margins of the ASP, it's clear that a multi-pronged strategy is really essential to prevent impunity for the Taliban regimes of oppression. I'd like to briefly introduce a few of the more significant avenues for gender justice in Afghanistan, particularly avenues that have unfolded even further over the last 3 months. In September, Australia, Canada, Germany, and the Netherlands formally called on the Taliban to immediately cease its violations of the rights of women and girls, taking the first step towards a contentious case before the International Court of Justice under the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Less than 2 weeks ago, the UN Sixth Committee voted to move formal negotiations on the draft Crimes Against Humanity Convention, and in large part to the advocacy of Afghan human rights defenders, many of whom are on this panel and many of whom are also in attendance here today. Some states have already signaled their support for the inclusion of the crime of gender apartheid in that convention. Of course, it's still early stages, and this is a work in progress. There is also work underway at the ICC, as we know, as we heard just now. The Office of the Prosecutor has been investigating the situation in Afghanistan since 2022, and it has signaled its commitment to focus specifically on accountability for gender-based crimes. And in light of the more limited public information available about those investigations, just last week, 6 states, including our sponsors this evening, Chile, Costa Rica, Luxembourg, and Mexico, submitted a letter of referral to the prosecutor documenting the deteriorating human rights environment for Afghan women and girls. The prosecutor's response the next day provided reassurance that concrete results from the investigation are forthcoming. So tonight, we are joined by an esteemed panel of speakers who will examine these and other avenues for justice and accountability in Afghanistan. And I'm happy to introduce our panelists. From my far left, we have Emily Fowell, who is the program lawyer at the International Bar Association's Human Rights Institute, where she's worked on Afghanistan for the last 4 years. And included in her portfolio of work and her pretty incredible accomplishments is that she worked on evacuating 103 female judges and lawyers and their families who were being persecuted. And in her capacity with the IBA's program, she's worked on gender persecution and advancing the case for codifying gender apartheid. Next, we have Professor Hannah Gary. She's the executive director of the Promise Institute at UCLA School of Law in Los Angeles, and a fellow Californian. I appreciate that. She's been a scholar, teacher, and practitioner of international criminal law transitional justice, and refugee law for over 20 years. She's practiced as a senior legal advisor in cases involving genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and torture before the ICC, ICTY, ICTR, ECCC, the Lebanon Tribunal, and the U.S. Supreme Court. Maybe we should list where she hasn't argued. She's also been involved in the End Gender Apartheid campaign since its launch on International Women's Day in 2022. Next, we have Azada Raz Mohammed, and she's a legal advisor for the Strategic Litigation Project at Atlantic Council and a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne in Australia, teaching and a teaching associate at Monash University. She's worked with Afghanistan's justice institutions, administrative office of the Afghan president, and as an adjunct lecturer at the American University of Afghanistan. She's also the co-author of the Handbook on Universal Jurisdiction, Holding the Taliban Accountable for International Crimes, which was just published this year. Hopefully we can get a copy. Next, we have Horia Mossadegh. She's the executive director of Safety and Risk Mitigation Organization and has more than 20 years of experience conducting research and advocacy to defend human rights in Afghanistan, including for the Europe Institute of Peace and Amnesty International. In 2015, she was awarded Afghan's Human Rights Award by the Shahar Foundation for this work. And finally, to my immediate left, is Mariam Safi. She's the executive director of the Organization for Policy Research and Development Studies, which is known as DROPS. And she has spearheaded transformative initiatives since the organization's establishment in Afghanistan in 2014. Now operating from Canada, DROPS remains impactful across all 34 provinces of Afghanistan, known for its innovative approaches to digital research, public policy analysis, and advocacy. She'll tell us more about the pretty phenomenal structure that she's established in polling and identifying the views of Afghan women. And finally, before we turn to our roundtable discussion, we have a recorded message from Lady Kennedy, KC. And Baroness Kennedy is a member of the Bar, King's Counsel, and bencher at Gray's Inn, and the director of the International Bar Association's Human Rights Institute. She has been a strong advocate for social justice and the rule of law in the House of Lords. And in 2021, when Afghanistan fell to the Taliban, together with Emily, she helped evacuate 103 women judges and prosecutors who were on the death list, along with their families, which totaled over 500 individuals. So with that, we'll listen to Lady Kennedy before we turn to our roundtable discussion.
I wanted to be with you, and I can't, I'm sorry to say, but I'm glad of the opportunity of saying a few words. I just wanted to deal with the fact that I do think that the International Criminal Court is the perfect venue for dealing with the terrible trajectory that there has been since the return of the Taliban into government in Afghanistan, because the effect on women's lives has been absolutely horrifying. And the men who are in leadership roles within the Taliban should be called to account. There has to be accountability for the crimes that have been committed against women, really, really egregious crimes, which are withdrawing their rights to freedom of association, freedom of speech, freedom to participate in their societies. I believe undoubtedly, because we've held here in the British Parliament, in which I sit in the House of Lords, we've held an inquiry into gender apartheid and what is happening in Afghanistan. And we heard testimony, and we're now in close contact with women who actually have experienced torture. They've been arrested because of demonstrating and protesting about the removal of rights, and then in turn have been in custody, seriously violated and abused, subjected to violent treatment in the hands of the men who were interrogating them, and in custody where it was men who were overseeing their detention. And that evidence in itself amounts to persecution. Of that, I am confident, having spent my whole life of 50 years now practicing at the bar, evaluating evidence as to whether it passes the threshold for example, arrest warrants. Now, can I just mention that the inquiry that we held was looking at the issue of gender apartheid. And why do we feel that that might be an additional need for the women of Afghanistan? Because apartheid, the very word tells you, is about forcing a part of the population to be apart and not to be participants in the full meaning of citizenship and membership of a society. These women are not being able to build their society. They're being turned into passive objects by the men who are running the country at the moment. They are not allowed association. They're not even in the most sort of humane ways of women being able to go to hairdressers or beauticians, where women meet and gather and talk and where they can share knowledge. That's not happening. And where they can't even go to a tailor to have new clothes made, where they are not allowed to sing or have their voices heard in public. And if their voices are heard singing, for example, outside of their homes, but overheard, that too could be a criminal offence. The reach of these new laws that have been introduced are so appalling and diminishing of the humanity of women in this nation, and that in itself is apartheid. It's the only way to describe it because it's institutionalised. It's affecting all women, not just women who protest, or it's affecting all women, and it is diminishing the status of women and the role that women can play in the building of a fair and just society. So for me, this is a serious issue of law. Law has to be about creating and protecting the rights of women. And that's not happening in Afghanistan anymore. So I urge the conference and the gathering to really press for a role to be taken by the International Criminal Court, for which I have great respect. A role should be taken in seeking to bring accountability for these terrible crimes against women that are currently taking place.
So turning now to our roundtable discussion, Miriam and Horia, maybe you can kick us off and share with us, and Baroness Kennedy touched on some of them, but the developments in Afghanistan since August 2021, which has culminated in the morality law. Can you share with us some of the legal and factual developments on the ground and the reality of what Afghan women are living today?
Thank you very much, Christina. It's a great pleasure to be here with you all today. Over the past 3.5 years, the Taliban have announced about 122 edicts. Majority of these edicts have targeted the fundamental rights and freedoms of women and girls, effectively relegating them to house arrest. This represents the most oppressive situation for women and girls globally today. These decrees were codified in July of 31st of this year in the official Gazette of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan under the Law on the Propagation of Virtue and Prevention of Vice, the PVPV law, as it's known. In Afghanistan today, women are not only prohibited from attending school beyond grade 6, working or leaving their home without a male relative, but they are also now required to veil their entire bodies, including their face, when in public or near men who are not close relatives. Disturbingly, the law now also equates women's voices with her private parts, which it refers to as aurat in Arabic. And the reason for this is that the Taliban always claimed that women's issues is an internal matter of Afghanistan. And now what they're trying to say with this is that women's voices is an internal matter of the household. So it's not only is it not an issue of the international community, but it's not an issue of the state either. And declaring that women's voices cannot be heard loudly in public and banning them from singing or reciting religious hymns. what was restricted, basically the gist of the PVPV law, is what was restricted through edicts that were either verbal or oral, is now prohibited by law. That is the gist of PVPV law. And while it has codified these edicts now, so it's made them punishable by law, there are also new components as well to this. And the new components, of course, is women's voices being heard in public, but it's also other components like misuse of internet, for example, is one component of it. But what constitutes misuse of internet? It could mean just about anything. For example, preventing disobedience of to parents. You can only imagine what this could mean for things like underage marriage, forced marriage of girls. For example, if a girl stands against their parents for that, does that equate to disobedience? So what we're seeing now in Afghanistan is that when the Taliban leadership passes a decree and the decree is not unanimously implemented across the country, then the leadership announces another decree. And when the morality law came about, we can assume that one of the reasons why it did was because the Taliban's decrees were not being implemented systematically across all provinces. And our surveys were finding that because Taliban authorities in different provinces were treating them differently. But now that this is actual law, one of the main reasons for it was to make sure that it is implemented exactly as the leadership states it to be implemented. In order to make that happen, they have created a Department of Complaints for the PVPV law, where the Taliban analyzes the complaints that come to them. And it's really interesting the way that they then make decisions upon it. It's solely based on their interpretation of Sharia. But they also have a department with police inspectors that just monitor the implementation of the PVPV law, and they also monitor who violates it, including it being anyone from within their own authority. So when the PVPV law was announced, what we saw on the ground was a very swift implementation process, which we could only assume that they had created the structures for already in the country. So they had created the right departments, the right force, the right intelligence units. They had all of that created, and then they announced the PVPV law to make sure that it was implemented as the emir wanted. When this happened in September, our organization surveyed 20 women across 20 provinces to ask them how the morality law was impacting them. And this is the thematic threads in their responses, which I'd like to share with you. One was this notion of systematic exclusion. The law systematically erases women from public spaces, severely limiting their social, educational, and economic participation. One of our participants from Kabul said, and I quote, "This law gives the auditors an excuse to exclude women from society." Loss of autonomy was another. Women have lost personal choice over their clothing and behavior, facing forced compliance. And I quote one of our respondents from Paktia. She said, "The hijab should be worn for Allah's sake, not forced by anyone." Third, violation of rights. The morality law contravenes Islamic teachings and fundamental human rights, denying women education, work, and freedom of expression. And one of our participants from Badakhshan says, and I quote, "This law has questioned our religious views and hardened all civil rights of women." Fourth, mental health and an emotional toll. Widespread reports of depression, anxiety, and isolation underscore the devastating mental health impact. And one of our respondents from Parwan told us, "Women will be locked up in their homes and eventually become depressed, commit suicide, or go for underage marriages." And lastly, the economic impact. With restricted mobility and work opportunities, families face economic hardship and great societal regression. And our participant from Baghdad, from Baghdi said to us, "This law hinders the growth and progress of all women." And so those are the views from women across the country just 2 months after the morality law was announced. And so basically the notion it espouses is that of a situation that has just become deteriorated to unprecedented levels for them. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much, Mariam John, for describing the situation after the PVPV law was launched by the Taliban in September. I would like to go a little bit back, like in August 2021, when Taliban were brought to power as a result of a U.S. And Taliban agreement that was signed in February 2020. It was like a moment of great regression for many of us. Like on 14th of August, we were politicians, we were journalists, we were university professors, we were teachers, we were students. We were working women, and we were active in different aspects of life. On the 15th of August, we woke up being no one. Our very identity had been taken away from us, and we felt once again that we were betrayed by the United Nations, by the members of the international community, and by very countries who first justified war on terror in 2021 to let's liberate Afghan women. And since August 2021, the life of Afghans in total, but especially the life of Afghan women and girls, it's going downhill. Girls beyond year 6, they are not allowed to go to school. Universities have been closed. Women are not present in any government offices. And even last year in November, December, Taliban also banned women from working in humanitarian agencies. That followed by closure of the beauty salons, preventing women from going to parks, stopping restaurants from allowing women to enter and have a feast. Even families cannot go to the restaurant to eat. It doesn't stop here. I think with the propagation of vice and prevention of virtue law, it was just, making sure that everything that the Taliban's leader is putting in word, it is being enforced. But at the same time, as a woman, what I see the situation in Afghanistan, for me as a mother, what could be the most terrible moment is that once I lived under the Taliban, and now my daughters have to live under the Taliban. And for many women who are not lucky to get out of the country, for many girls who are not lucky to get out of the country, they have to live under that situation every day. One of the women, she was saying that maybe it's easier for the Taliban to dig a big hole and bury us all alive. That might be something. So the end result, because we don't see anything else that can go bad, but then there is another thing. Once something is happening, we are saying, okay, that might be the end of it. No, something else happens. And also what is really the most disturbing is that we as Afghans, we knew what will come with the Taliban. We kept warning the members of the international community that Taliban have not changed, and Taliban are the same group that were implementing a state of gender apartheid in 1990s. But again, the same Western diplomats were telling us that, oh, they are reformed Taliban. We are talking to like-minded Taliban. They are the second generation of the Taliban. They are very different from the first Taliban. And we kept saying, no, Taliban have not changed. But then again, because we were concerned about the future of Afghanistan and Afghan women, then we were branded as warmongers, as a bunch of elite women sitting in Kabul who are detached from the realities of Afghanistan. And with all the due respect to some of the diplomats that are now sympathizing with our cause, to be honest, I think everyone else is just shedding a crocodile tears. They knew what's happening. They knew what's coming with the Taliban. But still, they decided to agree and allow Taliban to come. And even now, like from the one hand, we are hearing from here and there, oh, what can we do for you? Oh, what can we do for you? But from the other hand, what we are really seeing is, on a weekly basis, over $40 million cash since August 2021 is given to the Taliban under the name of the humanitarian aid. There have been multiple reports that is coming that those money are being used for the Taliban's military purposes to feed Taliban soldiers who are going around and implementing gender apartheid, war crimes, and execution of civilians and former Afghan National Security Forces. What's most disturbing for us is that many, not just Russia, not just China, not Turkey and other countries, but some of the Western countries are already in some kind of soft recognition of the Taliban. Many diplomats are racing to have a photo with one of the wanted terrorists and put it on their profile or on the website. We know that you should negotiate, you should engage with the Taliban. But at the same time, we want those engagements to be principled. We want those engagements to bring something back on the table. In the past 3 years, all we are hearing is that we condemn the Taliban. And then some of them go a little bit beyond, and they're saying we are condemning the Taliban with the strongest term. What is beyond condemnation? When we will move out of condemnation, when we are going to take some practical steps? We have documented since August 2021 till now, every time when the international community engaged with the Taliban, Taliban have put even harder restrictions on Afghan women. They have came up with more creative ways of imprisoning women and limiting our liberties, our fundamental liberties. So simply, your engagement is not doing us any good. Simply, bringing Taliban on the table has failed in the past 3 years. I'm really struggling to understand how long the international community want to continue bribing the Taliban for doing nothing but to limit Afghan people, especially Afghan women. And this is not just the situation about the Afghan women and girls. This is not about gender apartheid that's happening on the ground on a daily basis. This is also about every single Afghan woman and man who are suffering, who are suffocated under the Taliban. There is no freedom of expression and association. Women protesters are being detained and put into detention centers. They are being raped. They are disappeared. They are killed. Even their family members are punished because these women are daring to go on the streets. We have like thousands of members of the former National Security Forces who are being summarily executed, and no one is asking any question from the Taliban. The state of torture and enforced disappearances happening on a daily basis. And even the international humanitarian and aid community, that many of them are trying to sugarcoat what Taliban are doing and saying that, oh, but Taliban are allowing us to have this number of female staff. Taliban are allowing us to run our schools. But at the same time, the same members of the international humanitarian organizations, they have to pay a bribe to the Taliban. And those bribes have different forms. Those bribes are like a specific percentage of that humanitarian aid need to go to the families of the Taliban soldiers to feed their families. A specific number of that humanitarian aid, it really needs to go to the members of the Taliban who are killed and to their widows and to other family members. And at the same time, the same humanitarian aid, Taliban have to make a decision who can access those aid. They literally look into the list of the beneficiaries and they can decide that, yes, because this widow is belong to the former member of the Afghan government, because this widow is belong to the family of a former national security forces, you cannot give them any aid. But instead, that aid can go to that place, especially in the areas where armed resistance is happening in Afghanistan. That situation is even more bleak. Thank you.
Well, in light of these really sobering developments, thank you for educating all of us on what's been happening historically and as to recent. What can we do? What are the legal avenues? How do we take this forward? Azadeh, maybe you could outline for us some of the legal avenues for accountability vis-a-vis the de facto Taliban rule.
Thank you very much, Christina. Thank you very much, Christina. Good evening, everyone. Before I start, I wanted to apologize if I'm not very articulated this evening. Because as my colleagues were actually explaining the situation, and all day this week we have been attending a lot of panels on these issues, and then continuously, actually, we have to talk about this, and it's extremely draining for us, and it takes a lot of energy. And I usually invite my colleagues, my other colleagues in international criminal law, that they can actually have a private life and they can have a professional life, but for us, it's just a across the whole time. So I apologize if I'm not super articulated this evening. So based on the principles of international law, the first venue of accountability is with the national government or the national or domestic courts. But however, the former government of Afghanistan, who collapsed in August 15 of 2021, were always unable or unwilling to prosecute and investigate the alleged crimes committed by the Taliban and its affiliated group, and no matter how large-scale those crimes were. Afghanistan also lacked the jurisdictional and also institutional capacity to prosecute the alleged international crimes committed by the Taliban. However, since the Taliban's violent return in August 2021, holding the Taliban accountable for international crimes is imperative. As my colleagues were actually explaining the crimes that they have been committing in the past 3 years and beyond that. However, in the absence of a national mechanism, we need to refer to international avenues. As I explained, we didn't have a very robust national mechanisms before that, but ever since taking power, the Taliban has dismantled all our national justice institution. For the past 3.5 years, Afghanistan is the only country that we operate without any legal system. We don't have constitution. The Taliban has dismantled our 2004 constitution, penal codes that we had adopted in 2017, which had included the crimes within the Rome Statute of International Criminal Court. But now they have actually a country. We are a country now that being operated by decrees, as Mariam John and Huria John was explaining. And the Taliban has allegedly committed war crimes, crimes against humanity, which includes large-scale and deliberate attacks targeting civilians, protected sites, killing and wounding hundreds and thousands of civilians. As a recent study was saying that 100,000 civilians may have been killed by the Taliban. And continuously implementing an unprecedented gender-based crimes and persecution and gender apartheid. Therefore, at the international level, we recognize that in the absence of national prosecution mechanism, we may have 4 avenues for accountability. The first one is that ICJ, as Christina also referred to that in her opening remarks, I think for the first time, international community has taken a substantial steps towards accountability for gross human rights violation, where 4 countries of Germany, Australia, Netherlands, Canada has filed a dispute under CEDAW. We are cautiously optimistic and keenly following the developments on this case, and we're very much optimistic that a potential CEDAW case will involve a comprehensive approach and will include all rights that are protected under CEDAW, and we are very much concerned about any potential limitation or focus in one area, because as my colleagues were mentioning, that Taliban's unprecedented gender-based persecution and gender-based and gender apartheid involves all areas of women's rights. So we hope that this case will be a comprehensive one. Second, we actually refer to the universal jurisdiction. The principles of universal jurisdiction can be a very powerful mechanism to fight impunity in Afghanistan, such as war crimes and crimes against humanity that committed by the Taliban since their appearance. So the Taliban appeared in 1994, and they took the control of Afghanistan and the collapse of Kabul by 1996. And some of these crimes that were allegedly committed in the 90s and before the Rumi Statute was enforced in Afghanistan, we became a party to the Rumi Statute in 2003. We think that these crimes could actually fall within the universal jurisdiction. However, the case under universal jurisdiction could also be politically and also legally limiting. There could be limitations in terms of legal limitations. We believe that the alleged perpetrators should be present in the third country, and there's usually a nexus involved. Some countries do not implement pure, as we call it, pure universal jurisdiction, and that could be a challenging. And also often due to political consideration, a third country might be very reluctant to actually file or bring a case against a head of state or a Taliban delegation, that we hope that one day we will have a case like that. However, universal jurisdiction covers the alleged crimes that are being committed by the Taliban. In February of 2022, we got to know by diaspora community in one of European countries that a group of high-level Taliban delegations are traveling to one of the European capitals, very close to Netherlands. And among them is one person of interest who has been the only person probably who has been convicted by the Afghan courts for allegedly terrorism and international crimes, perhaps. And this person was among this delegation. But before we actually file a case, we knew that the next morning that person had fled the country because we had involved, unfortunately, the authorities. We thought that in the hope that they will actually result in arrest and conviction. So we still believe that the universal jurisdiction could actually be a very good complementary to the ICC, the potential ICC case as well. Third, my colleagues have been referring to the situation of Afghanistan as a gender apartheid. So a little bit brief overview of why we call our experience in Afghanistan as gender apartheid is that we have actually inherited this term from our predecessors, from the women of Afghanistan who fought against the Taliban's atrocities in the end of the 1990s. I apologize for the colleagues who were also in the panel that I was talking in details about gender apartheid, that I'm repeating myself, but I think it's important that to say that why we call our experience gender apartheid, because we believe that similar as the gender apartheid, the crime of apartheid that is based on race, the Taliban's institutionalized oppression of women is actually a system of apartheid, but based on gender. So this term is actually 30 plus years old, that started in the end of in the middle of 1990s when the women were actually fighting against the first term of Taliban being in power. So there is an opportunity for us to codify and criminalize gender apartheid under the draft convention or treaty and the currently being discussed at the United Nations. And we hope that there will be a willingness from the international community to support the codification of gender apartheid and the situation of Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. The apartheid system that they have been implementing will be a catalyst for change of international law, because not only the Taliban has actually issued these decrees that my colleagues were actually mentioned, but they have a very violent system of enforcing those. My colleagues were referring to the arbitrary arrests of women, but the Taliban has also dismantled the Ministry of Women's Affairs and have introduced the Ministry of Vice and Virtue, which actually has a very violent flogging women. We have in the past few months at least, we have been hearing about public flogging of women, and they have been violently enforcing these decrees like that. I let my colleagues elaborate on ICC, but lastly, I wanted to say that, emphasize that we need both retributive justice and restorative justice and accountability for the crimes committed in Afghanistan, because these crimes are such large-scale atrocities. Not one of these avenues that I was mentioning, including the ICC that my colleague will elaborate, is responsive to this level of atrocities that's happening have been happening in Afghanistan for the past close to 5 decades. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Azada. Hannah, could you share with us your views on the ICC as an avenue for accountability?
Certainly. And I just want to say a big thank you for everyone who's come out this evening, and especially to my distinguished co-panelists. It's really an honor to be here this evening, and especially to Azada and Horia and Mariam. I know this has been an exhausting week, and we admire your courage and your resilience, and that you continue to speak out, and appreciate that you continue to do so at great personal cost. So I just want to express my gratitude, and also that our hearts are heavy and breaking with you. I want to thank the many co-sponsors that are here this evening that made this evening possible. I want to thank the ambassador for the courage of Chile and the other state sponsors in referring the situation in Afghanistan last week to the International Criminal Court, such an important step. And I want to start out my remarks and just say that, to emphasize the importance, I think, of sooner rather than later, of now, for international criminal charges against individual members, men, who are leading the Taliban at this point in time. So justice for Afghan women and girls and other genders in Afghanistan is long overdue. I've been teaching international criminal law for 13 years now, and Afghanistan, we study it every year. And there's been decades of violence with multiple colonial masters over the years that have led to this horrific situation. And there's been no justice over decades. And Horia has been saying that over and over again as we've been meeting with folks throughout the week. This, in the meantime, this systematic and institutionalized oppression that you're hearing about tonight is snuffing out all life for women, girls, and other gender groups in Afghanistan. And this grave violation of fundamental human rights is clearly intended to be comprehensive and complete and erasure from all public life. And so the results we are seeing now are high rates of suicide and maternal mortality, as well as widespread trauma amongst around at least half of the Afghan population. Charges by the OTP now would help prevent the normalization that you're hearing about with regard to the Taliban by the international community. It would signal a message that normalization is not okay. And it would hopefully deter ongoing and future abuses, hopefully. And it would provide some small ray of hope for the victims in this exceedingly dark time in Afghanistan. So in this regard, I'm really encouraged by the referral from last week and the prosecutor's statement on Monday that we will see applications for arrest warrants very soon. We pressed the prosecutor's office about that, and let it be so. So as a matter of bringing a case before, you know, the charges and the case that could be brought before the International Criminal Court, I think the case is clear here, especially with regard to gender persecution as a crime against humanity. There's clearly personal, temporal, territorial, and subject matter jurisdiction under the Rome Statute, under Articles 5, 7, 11, and 12. And as you've heard, Afghanistan's been a state's party since 2003. So that clearly captures all of the latest horrific violence of the Taliban 2.0 from August 2021 on to the present. In addition to gender persecution, and this is what I want to spend a little time talking about, there's an alternative theory that can be brought under subject matter jurisdiction, and that is gender apartheid as an other inhumane act, as a crime against humanity. And that can be brought under Articles 7.1K of the Rome Statute. And, I would posit and argue that this should be charged cumulatively with gender persecution as a crime against humanity. And as you may know, under the Rome Statute, persecution requires a connection to another underlying act under Article 7 of the Rome Statute. And here we have connection to almost all the underlying acts, including murder, enslavement, imprisonment, torture, crimes of sexual violence, and enforced disappearance, among others. And I think that we need to have cumulative charges for all of that to reflect the totality of the systematic deprivation of all fundamental human rights by the Taliban. And then clearly these crimes fit within the territorial and the nationality jurisdictions that's required here. With regard to complementarity and admissibility, under Articles 17 and 53 of the Rome Statute, as you've heard, there are currently no investigations or prosecutions by a state, including Afghanistan, that has jurisdiction. And indeed, in Afghanistan itself, as you've heard, the courts and judicial system are being weaponized against women, girls, and other genders. With regard to gravity as an admissibility requirement, I've already conveyed some of that gravity to you in my opening remarks, but I would just add that there's no question of sufficient gravity here in terms of scale, nature, manner of commission, and impact. All of the criminal acts that are involved involve sexual and gender-based violence, all of them, including rape, torture, and forced disappearances. The crimes are committed in widespread and systematic manner, and according to a de facto regime or organizational plan or policy. So let's talk a little bit about the less clear case, which is gender apartheid as another inhumane act, as a crime against humanity. There is an opportunity, I would argue here, to bring this theory forward, and I think I want to note that, importantly, we need to use the term gender apartheid in a multiplicity of ways in bringing forward charges in this case against the Taliban. And it's important because of what Azadeh just said. It's in the interest of justice for the prosecution to frame this grave harm against women and girls and other genders as gender apartheid, in addition to gender persecution, because they themselves have been doing so for decades. And this is not a Western concept. This comes directly from them, and we need to see that it is expressed as such in any charges that are brought under the Rome Statute. We can, you know, by gender apartheid, we're looking at the Rome Statute's definition of apartheid found in Article 7.2H as an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one group over another group, and here subbing in gender for race, committed with the intention of maintaining that regime. And the Taliban's actions clearly constitute apartheid on the basis of gender, as defined under Article 7.3 of the Rome Statute. The term gender apartheid should be used, in my view, for guiding the prosecutors, so as an expressive term, for guiding the prosecutors' ongoing investigations, evidence gathering, and fact-finding. As an expressive function, it should be used in the charging documents when bringing its cases against the Taliban. It can be used for framing the fact base in bringing the charges, for bringing forward the facts and evidence for meeting the chapeau elements for the crimes against humanity in Afghanistan, especially systematicity of the attack, but also the widespread nature directed against a distinct civilian population. And it can be used for proving the gravity threshold that I described, which is clearly met. And finally, articulating all of this within the frame of the term gender apartheid is clearly in the interest of justice, again, recognizing that this is Afghan women's own characterization of their suffering. With regard to actually charging the crime of gender apartheid as another inhumane act, although it's not yet codified in the Rome Statute, the Taliban's practices and laws resulting in gender apartheid can constitute an under inhumane act because the regime of gender apartheid consists of serious violations of fundamental rights in violation of customary international law, amounting to gender apartheid. And so charging it as another inhumane act is important because the intent, the animating context, and institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and violation of fundamental rights is distinct from other enumerated crimes against humanity, including gender persecution. Gender apartheid more accurately describes the factual situation and is in line with the object and purpose behind the prohibition of apartheid, where regimes are using the power of systems and institutions to enforce their ideology against other groups and make them second-class citizens. And this is exactly what's happening in Afghanistan. Such framing is in line also with the object and purpose of other inhumane acts as crimes against humanity. similar to the Martin's Clause in the laws of war, international humanitarian law. And that object and purpose is to prevent and punish grave, serious human rights abuses that are not yet enumerated in the statute or codified under international law. And they are the purpose being to prevent the unthinkable, not yet imagined crimes from going unpunished. As we know, the law is often one step behind the malignant creativity of human beings, such as the leadership of the Taliban. So finally, in closing, I would strongly suggest that another avenue for accountability that states parties, and I'm looking at you, Ambassador, could consider is to engage through the ICC in putting forward a proposal to the Assembly of States Parties Working Group for amendments to the Rome Statute to include gender apartheid as a crime against humanity, similar to what was recently done by Vanuatu, Fiji, and Samoa with regard to ecocide. And with that, I'll close. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Hannah. Emily, would you like to share your views?
Thank you so much, and also just want to reiterate my thanks for all of our amazing panelists so far and sharing their experience. It's so valuable to hear from you, and I know how difficult it is to keep going all of this week, so thank you so much. To complement Hannah's remarks, I just wanted to make three points about why it's so important that the International Criminal Court acts now, in line with the prosecutor's statement that they're looking for concrete action to come out. So firstly, as you heard from Baroness Kennedy, this year we convened an inquiry in the British Parliament into gender apartheid to really raise the voice of Afghan women in Parliament and what different routes of accountability will look like. And the recommendations coming out of that are really in line with what the UN Special Rapporteur in Afghanistan called for, which is an all-tools approach to justice is needed to counter the Taliban's systemic and institutionalized discrimination against women. So it's imperative that all avenues of justice are used, and obviously we've seen the historic case brought before the ICJ under CEDAW, which is the first action brought before CEDAW, and similarly what is needed now is the first prosecution for gender persecution by the International Criminal Court. This is the most egregious violation of women's rights we're seeing worldwide, but this is something that impacts us, all of us, as part of a global rollback of women's rights. After everything we've seen in Iran with the Women Life Freedom Movement and the crackdown on women's rights there, now we're seeing in Libya attempts to bring a morality police to enforce compulsory veiling as well. This is something that impacts all of us, and it's about reinforcing the commitment of international law to fighting for women's rights, which is a fight that was started really many, many years ago by Chinkin and Charlesworth and Wright, but is still yet to see really fruition. So recently, of course, we've had the judgment in Hausan regarding crimes in Mali, but it was very disappointing to see that the charges of gender persecution were not actually confirmed by the court. So this is a real opportunity to see international criminal law being used to uphold women's rights and uphold the importance of women's rights in the whole of international law. Secondly, as we've heard very powerfully from everyone, there is absolutely no hope for justice domestically. And so the International Criminal Court, in looking at criminal liability of individuals, in addition to the state responsibility before the International Court of Justice, provides some hope that those most responsible for upholding this system of gender apartheid in Afghanistan can be held accountable. And the Criminal Court is unique in its offering to allow victims to participate throughout that process. And so we hope to see charges forthcoming which reflect the wishes of victims to see justice and to see it now. Thirdly, at a time when we're seeing, and just to say, of course, Baroness Kennedy wish she could be here, but I know this is a point she definitely want me to raise, which is now we're at a time where we're seeing unprecedented threats to the international legal order and specifically the International Criminal Court and interference in the independence of the court. And to see the state party's referral from the six states to the International Criminal Court's work and to call for the court to advance justice for female victims is really encouraging to see support to the court and the upholding of international law more widely. As a part of this, I think Hannah touched on this briefly, but just to reemphasize that, of course, it's essential that if charges are brought, that this will require member states of the Rome Statute to uphold any arrest warrants issued and therefore will draw
prevent engagement with the Taliban as the de facto authorities. And we've, of course, heard very powerfully from Horia about why that's so imperative that that happens now. We've seen the international recognition that the Taliban were trying to seek from the takeover in 2021 and continue to seek, you know, through engagements in the Doha peace processes, which have recently prohibited women from partaking as well. And so any charges brought now would draw an absolute red line in the sand that the international community is not willing to engage with the Taliban while their crimes against women are ongoing and while crimes against women, other genders, minority groups, and all the people of Afghanistan are ongoing, that will not be overlooked.
Thank you, Emily. I'm going to turn one more question before we turn to the Q&A, and that's for Miriam. So we've talked about gender apartheid in various capacities, one in the Crimes Against Humanity Convention, the codification effort, and also the possibility of charges or usage of the term from a contextual standpoint by the ICC. Could you tell us why gender apartheid is important to the women of Afghanistan, and is there support for it domestically?
Thank you very much for that question. Is this on? Yes, it is. I'm going to share with you a few key data points that we've been able to gather through our Bishnau survey tool that we deploy every 2 months across Afghanistan to gather women's opinions on key issues, key needs, demands. And we have a reach now in all 34 provinces, and we survey just a little over 8,000 women at this particular point. And that may help give an idea of why we think it's gender apartheid. We've surveyed them on specifically gender apartheid as well, and I'll share those. But just generally to give you an understanding of what they have been telling us since we relaunched our work in Afghanistan in May of 2022. So in February, we carried out a survey with 3,640 respondents to understand how Afghan women describe their conditions amidst the 100-plus edicts that the Taliban had announced, curtailing all of their rights. We found that 62% identified the Taliban's actions as deliberate efforts to create a society where women and girls are subordinate to men. Furthermore, 67% described the restrictions as systematic oppression, a characterization echoed by international experts as gender apartheid. The Taliban's actions have gone beyond restricting rights to weaponizing marriage as a tool of oppression. Families increasingly marry off their daughters to avoid unions with Taliban leaders or as a survival strategy amidst economic insecurity. Early enforced marriages are no longer confined to rural areas, but are rising sharply in urban centers, where they had reversed over the 20 years of the Republic. Our research on underage marriage revealed really devastating trends. In 2023, 69% of 3,848 respondents told us that they knew someone in their family or community who had married a daughter at an inappropriate age. Amid this dire backdrop, Afghan women have continued to resist. In small but meaningful ways, they have built solidarity networks, they've educated their daughters secretly, they've engaged in acts of defiance to preserve their dignity and their hope. But this is taking a really devastating toll on their physical and mental health. In March of 2023, we surveyed a little over 2,000 respondents and asked them if they knew of a woman or girl in their community who had suffered from mental health since the Taliban had taken over. 47.6 said yes. 7.8% said they knew someone who had attempted suicide. 6.6% said they knew someone who had self-harmed. In percentages, this might look small, But in actual figures, this is quite a lot. And this is just 2,000 women that we had surveyed at this particular time who said that yes. About 178 of them said they knew someone who attempted suicide. Now, if I go survey half of the population of Afghanistan, which are women, 20 million or so, you can imagine how this number would rise, right, to alarming, alarming rates. Despite this resilience, the international community's current approach has utterly failed. Not only has it failed, but engagement without accountability has emboldened the Taliban, has normalized the Taliban, and has basically reaffirmed the Taliban's notion of women's issues remaining to be an internal matter. That's what it's done so far. Therefore, the actions from Chile is incredibly welcomed. And I thank you so much. After such a long time, we had some positive news. So we really, really appreciate it. And we will not forget it. Thank you. The Taliban leader, Haybatullah Khunzada, openly declared that their jihad aimed to implement a strict Sharia system, rejecting any negotiation on human rights or women's freedoms. His words, and I quote, "The Taliban see engagement as a tool to suppress opposition." He made a remark once that said that he would never engage with the international community on these matters. And the Taliban see engagement as a tool to suppress opposition, not a pathway to reform. There's no 2.0 Taliban, 2.0 in a worse sense probably, but there's no reform, there's no change. They're a lot worse now than they were when they were in power from 1996 till 2001. They didn't have a morality law at that particular time. They had edicts, but they didn't have a morality law. But you're also working with a different Taliban group. You're working with a Taliban group that is now highly sophisticated, trained. You're working with a Taliban group whom at the lower level are young. They're incredibly young. They're 25 years old, 27, 28 years old. These are individuals that have grown up in a different generation with the social media at the tips of their hands. They know well how to use it and execute it. So this is a different group altogether that we're talking about. Now, adding to the urgency of the matters that were discussed, Taliban groups, one of the things that we haven't touched upon, which I think is also incredibly important, is that terrorist groups, international terrorist groups, thrive under Taliban rule. Make no misconception. No, there's the terrorist organizations that are operating in Afghanistan have not decreased since the Taliban were took control. They have grown in numbers. With alliances like those with Al-Qaeda, the TTP becoming much stronger. Al-Qaeda in 2015, 16, a lot of research was showing numbers of being about 50 in Nangarhar province. Al-Qaeda is now in the 1500s. So it's grown. Their alliance has become much stronger. Afghanistan is now a haven for extremist ideology, facilitated by the proliferation of formal, informal, and jihadi madrasas. 39% of a little over 8,000 women we surveyed just this October on girls' enrollment in madrasas told us that they have noticed that girls that are attending madrasas, they have noticed a stronger preference in them for observing the full hijab at home. So girls who are attending madrasas, there is a very severe reversal, should I say, of their perception of what women's rights are and should be. So this backlash is not only happening at the community level, at the family, community and family level, but it's actually happening now within the girls. And we had never seen that ever in Afghanistan. It's like it's almost a radicalization of now young girls across the country. boys, absolutely, but amongst girls, we had never seen. So wearing formal hijab within the home means covering your face in front of your father. These girls feel that this is now, this is a religious duty of theirs. Amongst this, so then we've noticed that 16% of our respondents noticed that there was a decline within them, in a decline in interest in formal education. So girls that are attending madrasas now have less interest in going back into formal education. And 11% reported an increase in desire for early marriage as well. So girls that are attending madrasas, which are open for girls of all age, and I believe that the reason for this being the creation of madrasas, the Taliban passed an edict to increase madrasas by 10% across the country. And I think one of the reasons for this was to push families to send their daughters to madrasas. And a lot of families are now forced to not send their kids to primary education. There's community pressure, religious pressure from their communities. So they're sending them to madrasas. And I think they're trying to create the foundation to say, well, we have madrasa education. We don't need to open formal schools. The way, yes, so the way I see it, I don't think formal schools are opening for girls ever. And I think madrasas are being sold as the best alternative. And I'm really sorry to say, but a lot of folks in the international community are really eating this up and they're being convinced. But what this is doing is providing radicalization, because we don't have any clarity on the curriculum of these madrasas. And so now you're going to have an entire population of boys and girls radicalized, because the Taliban's ideology of jihad is no longer limited to the territory of Afghanistan. They believe, as the Islamic Emirate, who beat the United States and NATO as a whole, is now the sort of, is their emir is the emir of the entire emirate. That emirate is not confined within the borders of Afghanistan. They want to extend. And this is something that we really need to think of. And I think they're trying to prepare the population for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mariam. I think that this, especially this last point on the deception, is really an important point for everyone to keep in mind, just that reopening of schools in this deceptive way that is intended to radicalize and appear as if it's appeasing critics is, you know, important point to keep in mind. So with that, I'd like to open it up for questions. And we intended this to be a dialogue. So is anyone? Yes.
Rahela Kavir, the Director of Afghan Women Empowerment Organization. Thank you so much, Excellency Ambassador and distinguished speakers. And a special thanks for the efforts are done for codifying the gender apartheid as international law. So, and also we know that to codify this law needs more time, probably years. But my question is, how long we need, or how long it will take that the gender apartheid come as an international law? And another question is, what will be the achievement by codifying the apartheid, gender apartheid as international law versus the gender persecution? What changes we will expect for the woman status in Afghanistan and overall the globe? Thank you.
Let's take two more questions before we have the response. Yes.
Hello, good evening, everyone, and I hope you will not be tired. That was very interesting. And before I say something, our great panelists deserve to have, we did a clapping for them, a high-level clapping for them, but we didn't. Yeah, thank you. That is great, because this is the question of gender. We have to really encourage our sisters who are really working hardly to raise their voices on supporting women. So thank you. I have a small clarification, but I want to say something, not a question. If in case prosecutor Karim Khan said that very soon we will issue the warrant arrest for the perpetrator of gender crimes in Afghanistan, but in case if prosecutor will not issue that warrant that we expect very soon from him or from the office of the prosecutor, Shamiso is also sitting here, so what steps we need to take, really? Because I'm afraid Taliban is continuously trying to ban women from all other small facilities that they are now have. They're trying to put them, to impose further ban and prohibitions on women. And this is really, there is no need that I should say it is crime. It's a crime. It's a crime against humanity. It is, from all the perspectives that we see that what is happening in Afghanistan, it is crimes against humanity, and we expect from the court and the office of the prosecutor to approve or to codify gender apartheid in the territory of crimes against humanity. What I'm saying, if in that case, what next step or what measures we have to take in case prosecutor not take any practical steps to issue arrest warrant against the perpetrators of crimes against humanity and gender victims who are really waiting in Afghanistan and expecting. Because all women are victims in Afghanistan. All women are victims in Afghanistan. We have to think about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Nahid Shahalimi. I'm the founder and managing director of We the Women. My question is to the Afghans, and I would hope that you can answer this question, and then the answer to that question comes to the rest. My question to all three of you is, as Afghans all across the world, outside of Afghanistan and inside of Afghanistan, there are many networks, steering committees that we work, all of us are in. What do you need as support from the rest of them in order for you to achieve the goals that we have all been discussing in the past 2 days? Thank you.
One more question from this side. Yes.
Thanks. I want to thank everyone for their interventions. My question is less technical on international law and more advice I seek. Essentially, as it often happens, progressive arguments are co-opted by right-wing movements. And the situation in Afghanistan, gender apartheid, unfortunately, very easily becomes co-opted by right-wing sentiment in the neighborhood to use it to fuel already problematic, like anti-Muslim sentiment in the subcontinent. And so my question is, how does one sort of respond to those arguments, meet those arguments, counter those arguments? So that's the question / advice.
Great questions. Who wants to kick us off? Maybe Azada.
Thank you very much. I think I'll start with answering the last question. I think that's a very important question, and we have been actually asked that before too. That I have been specifically asked that you're advocating for codification of gender apartheid, and Taliban claims to be upholding the strict interpretation of Sharia law. Does that mean that you're actually working against the principles of Sharia law? Taliban's systematic oppression of women and implementation of gender apartheid is not an Islamic principle. Islamic law has actually, if you look at, I'm not an Islamic law expert, but I have the, enough knowledge to actually say that it's not based on principles of Sharia law. Islam actually provides a lot of rights for women. My colleagues probably adhere to that. Islam actually were the first religion to, which allowed women to have business, right to divorce, and Afghanistan has always been an Islamic republic, even before the Taliban's return. We had the Article 1 of our constitution, 2004 constitution, and the constitution before that had said that Afghanistan is an Islamic republic, and nothing against the values or principles of Sharia law can be implemented in Afghanistan. That means that we had Sharia law. Our penal code, our criminal code, was based on the crimes as we have in Sharia law. So Taliban's just rhetoric to Islamic principles is baseless, and whatever they're implementing is not based on Sharia law, but an ideology deeply rooted in misogyny. So actually, we have been coming a lot about this, and then the answer is that we always have been an Islamic republic, and we always had Sharia law as the main principle of law in Afghanistan.
Yeah, thank you. I think in regard to your question, we have two very strict Islamic countries in the world. One is Iran for the Shias and Saudi Arabia for the Sunnis. We haven't seen any of what happens in Afghanistan, in at least in these two countries, in Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
you haven't seen the example of it in any other Islamic country around the world. So how can Taliban justify that as an Islamic practice, especially if we look at the neighboring country, Pakistan? Like, you know, the situation is incomparable. If you look to the situation of Iran, the situation is absolutely incomparable. So for that reason, I think, as Azadejan already mentioned, it is just deep-rooted in not just the misogyny, but fear of women and art. That is the brand of the Taliban. If you take that away, you're not Taliban anymore. And thank you, Nahijan, for your question. I think what we really need from the people around this table and beyond is solidarity, empathy, and to understand our situation, because many times, my concerns have been dismissed by some international experts or expatriates or whoever you want to call. And they're trying to teach me and lecture me about what is my religion and what's my culture. They're telling me and justifying to me that what Taliban are doing, don't you think it's part of your culture? Don't you think it's part of your religion? So what I really want, please do not justify what happens in Afghanistan under the name of the religion or culture. My mother, my grandmother, they lived freely in Afghanistan, more free than my daughters today now. We were Muslim then, and we are Muslim now. And we were traditional people then, and we are traditional people now. Don't justify that. Don't come and lecture me about my religion and about my culture. And this is all I want to ask you. I don't want you to go on the street and chant with me. All I want you to understand that no discrimination, no apartheid, no violence could be justified under the name of the religion and under the name of the culture.
Is there anything more to add to that?
No, I think we're done covered it. I mean, the only thing I would say is that the Taliban is a de facto authority. They are not a legitimate government. They are not. You cannot consider them a legitimate government. They have not been elected. An emir is the Taliban structure as such is that an emir is appointed by a group of clergy, a small group, and then he becomes Emir al-Mu'mineen. So there is no elections within the emirate structure. There is no space for elections. So it's self-appointed. And therefore, this is not a legitimate government that reflects the aspirations and the needs and the wants of the people of Afghanistan. If they hold elections and they are elected, then we will sit and talk. But you are not an elected government. So they are but an authority. And just in response to the question about right-wing authorities, you know, co-opting, you know, I would say one of the best responses that you could give to the right-wing groups would be just scare them by telling them about the security threat that the Taliban will pose globally if you continue to let them go on in the way that they're moving forward. This is going to bleed beyond the borders of Afghanistan. We have been saying this for years. We're already seeing it. The Taliban launched a missile attack in Uzbekistan for the first time in decades. I mean, Uzbekistan had a missile from Afghanistan thrown at it. It's crazy. The TPP has grown stronger. Attacks are increasing all across Pakistan, for example. Radicalization, mobilization across Central Asia is increasing rapidly. I mean, this is just only about time. So these are things that we definitely need to keep in mind.
Hannah, would you like to chime in on the question of gender persecution versus gender apartheid or ethnic? Okay.
So just real quickly, because I know we're running short on time, Rahela, thank you so much for your questions with regard to gender persecution versus gender apartheid. I think we have to, that both need to be charged, both, under the Rome Statute first. And you can charge both. But it's very important to also charge gender apartheid as another inhumane act. And the reason I think for that is because, as you know, the concept of gender apartheid more accurately captures the nature of the grave harm that is being experienced in Afghanistan. And that nature is its institutionalized nature, is systematic nature through systems of governance, through the systems of the state, even though we all recognize the Taliban is not an official government, but is just a regime, an authority without, you know, being elected. But we have to recognize the seriousness and the gravity through the use of gender apartheid as another inhumane act, as a charge, in addition to gender persecution. Gender persecution certainly captures what's happening as well, but gender persecution, you know, can cover a whole range of types of persecution that are on a spectrum of gravity. And here, gender apartheid, it really gets to the heart of what it is, what is happening. And so, and then, of course, most importantly, it's because it is what the impacted population wants. This is how they describe their suffering. So that's that. And then, do we want to talk about timeline for codification?
If you can do it in 1 minute.
So we have good news about the draft articles of the Crimes Against Humanity Treaty moving forward, and there's a working group, and then plenipotentiaries, and there's a 5-year timeline so far. And Akila's in the room and could better answer this question than I could, but it will take some time for codification. We all know that. It also does take time to seek amendment to the Rome Statute, unfortunately. And so what I'm also working on is pushing it forward also as a customary international law norm. And there's ways to do that through, you know, getting states to sign on to a declaration or a resolution through the Human Rights Council. Unfortunately, these things do take time, but I think they're very much worth the effort.
And also looking historically at the usage of the term and
yes,
other
exactly.
ways. Well, please join me.
This good news also deserves to
do well. Yes. you're ahead of me.
Please join me in taking our panel.
Thank you. Thank you all for joining us, and we hope to continue the dialogue. Thanks.
Wonderful.